Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. A flood of headlines this week on the raging debate over torture and the release of Justice Department memos. President Obama said the Bush administration's memos on harsh interrogations showed more than poor judgment.
The OLC memos that were released reflected, in my view, us losing our moral bearings.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney went on Fox News to defend the interrogation program, suggesting it kept America safe.
I know specifically of reports that I read, that I saw, that lay out what we learned through the interrogation process and what the consequences were for the country.
In Pakistan, the Taliban moved closer to the capital and alarms went off in Washington. Here's U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
The Taliban in Pakistan are in fact an existential threat to the democratic government of that country.
Pakistani officials said they would keep a lid on it.
Pakistan is not going to be a failed state or a mortal threat to peace. We are going to convert it into a peaceful state.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines, and you can join the conversation. What's your take on the torture debate this week? Do you want investigations, prosecutions, or is it time to move on? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Andrea Seabrook, congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. Andrea, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Jane.
Hi, welcome. Joining me also in the studio here is David Gergen, professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a political analyst for CNN. He has advised four U.S. presidents, Republican and Democrat. David, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be here. Good to see you.
Thank you. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Andrea, and David.
David Gergen, I'll start with you. What do you make of this controversy that's evolved since the release of these so-called torture memos?
Well, it's a controversy, and it's a debate we need to have. It's gotten a little sharper than one might have expected us. This past few days. We've had more heat than light on trying to understand it. But I do think it goes back to the nation is fundamentally struggling here with people who each see a right, and the two rights are clashing. The nation has traditionally been a standard bearer for human rights, for standards of conduct, for trying to write the Geneva Conventions and to obey those Geneva Conventions. But the attack of 9/11 obviously rattled us, and it upset a lot of norms. And I think that it's in some ways understandable, but yet at the same time very regrettable that people after that took steps that clearly took us over the line. That I think waterboarding that is widely regarded, and the United States has traditionally regarded waterboarding as a form of torture, and we engaged in waterboarding extensively with at least three people. So I think this is abhorrent. At the same time, I think we do need to keep a sense of understanding and restraint that I thought was well reflected. And amidst all the cacophony this week, Admiral Dennis Blair, who was President Obama's choice to head up national intelligence, former admiral and who served with distinction, I thought was a model this week of restraint and moderation, understanding what happened, not trying to take it totally out of bounds, but also saying very firmly, we're changing directions. And we're not going to accept this as totally unacceptable behavior.
Andrea Seabrook, how is all this playing on Capitol Hill in Washington? We hear talk of truth commissions and investigations. I mean, where is Congress on all of this, and how hard are they going to push for more information?
Well, there's already a classified investigation going on inside the Senate Intelligence Committee, and there are a lot of ideas floating around about whether or not Congress should have some kind of truth commission or support an attorney, an inspector general within the Justice Department. What's happening up on Capitol Hill is it's creating a lot of friction between especially top Democrats who more than any time in their recent history would like to be unified. I mean, you see this in terms of the fact that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, supports a truth commission or some kind of congressional committee, while Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, does not, or at least is saying he wants to wait for the results of the classified investigation going on inside the Senate committee. And what's at stake here when you start heating up the divide between top Democrats is the rest of President Obama's agenda. And that is exactly what the White House top advisors to President Obama worried about when they discussed and debated whether to release these memos, that the debate over what to do now could inflame tensions on both the far left and the far right, and really overtake everything else that this White House would like to do.
We'll get to more of that in a minute, but Jack Beatty, let me turn to you about prosecutions, first of all. Who do you think might be prosecuted, and in your opinion, who should be prosecuted?
Well, first, let me try to put this in some perspective. I was just reading the last volume of Winston Churchill's History of the Great War, World War I, and he's summing up the war. What has the war done? And he said, oh, we've seen horrors. We've had submarine warfare, gas warfare, bombing of civilians, use of civilian hostages. We have been spared, he says, only the consummate moral horror of torture. He's talking about the Great War, and it took the last administration to take America over that line. That's the enormity of what we're dealing with here, and we have a larger audience to think about, the world. Mm-hmm. All over the world, people know we did this. In Pakistan, even the illiterates can pronounce the word Guantanamo. So what we need to show the world is we can do better. And when we make grave moral and national security mistakes like this, we correct them and we make the people who did them answer for it. I think all this, that the arrow of decision now points to Mr. Eric Holder. He said this week, we are going to follow the law, follow the evidence. Well, we'll see. Where does the law and evidence lead? Well, in the initial stage, it leads to these three quack attorneys who wrote these memos giving this kind of permission. But it may also lead to the people who pressured those, if they did, pressured those attorneys to write those opinions. And will Mr. Holder simply be satisfied with the internal investigation of the lawyers that might result in their disbarment? We don't know. Mm. Will he, on the other hand, appoint an independent counsel to be able to go wherever the evidence goes? We don't know. What we do know is that Mr. Holder has to discharge a burden, and that is that he, under the Clinton administration, he bowed to presidential pressure, it appeared, in the pardon of Mark Rich, in essentially rubber stamping that when he was in the Justice Department. He's got to clear that up in his record, and he doesn't want that to happen a second time.
Let me turn to Dick Cheney for a moment, David Gergen, because this week former Vice President Cheney defended these Bush-era interrogation tactics on Fox News, telling Sean Hannity that the release of more information on the methods in question is needed here.
One of the things that I find a little bit disturbing about this recent disclosure is they put out the legal memos, the memos that the CIA got from the Office of Legal Counsel, but they didn't put out the memos that show the success of the effort. And there are reports that show specifically what we gained as a result of this activity. They have not been declassified. I formally ask that they be declassified now.
David Gergen, what do you make of Dick Cheney's role in all of this?
Well, as abhorrent as I find many of the methods used and the whole process, I think Dick Cheney has a point that if there are classified memos which say that this actually worked, we should see those too. If we're going to have a complete understanding of it, let's have a complete understanding and not a one-sided understanding of it. To go back to Admiral Blair, he, in his own statement to his colleagues in National Intelligence this last week, in a memo he wrote, he said high-value information came from these interrogations in which these methods were used. Given that, I think that's the reason for having some restraint. And I part company with Jack Beatty, as I think Jack would probably anticipate, on this. It does seem to me that we need to press forward and understand what happened. And we need to understand, in fact, the whole war. How did we get into this war? Was there lying? We've never really answered that question about WMD. Were we misled into this war? How did we get into this torture business? I think we need a much more complete understanding of how we got here. I believe it is not, and I think President Obama has been right about this, I think that we should be paying more attention in terms of actually going after people. I think we should be moderate in doing that. It does seem to me it was right not to say the CIA employee should not be prosecuted in any fashion. And I have serious, deep reservations about launching some sort of prosecutorial special investigative effort by the Justice Department about lawyers who rendered their opinions. We have not done that in the past. It is going to have a hugely chilling effect, and it will destroy any semblance of bipartisanship in Washington if a new administration is seen to use the prosecutorial powers to go after a preceding administration.
David, I'm curious if you think, knowing Dick Cheney back to the Ford administration as you do, do you think he sees this as a policy difference with President Obama, not potentially a criminal issue?
Oh, absolutely. He sees his deep policy differences. Listen, I have – the Dick Cheney I knew in the 1970s was very different from the Dick Cheney who emerged as vice president. Let's put that for starters. And he and I parted company on many, many issues in the last few years. And I'm not in his corner in terms of a lot of what he stands for. At the same time, I think those who set him up as just this Darth Vader person, I think, misread him. I do think he has deep philosophical differences, and I do believe that he, with the president and with others, felt the United States was very much at risk in the days following September 11th.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week in the news. We're joined today by David Gergen of Harvard's Kennedy School and NPR's Andrea Seabrook. Also, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, Senior Editor of The Atlantic Magazine. President Obama, in an Oval Office meeting with King Abdullah of Jordan on Tuesday, spoke about the possible prosecution of those involved in the questionable interrogations of suspected terrorists.
For those who carried out some of these operations within the four corners of legal opinions or guidance that had been provided from the White House, I do not think it's appropriate for them to be prosecuted. With respect to those who formulated those legal decisions, I would say that that is going to be more of a decision for the Attorney General within the parameters of various laws, and I don't want to prejudge that.
Andrea Seabrook, what do you make of the president's position?
Well, I think, listening to David and Jack sort of thinking this out, I think one thing we haven't remembered in this discussion so far is that we live in a totally different world than the one that Churchill was writing in. We don't have the kind of luxury of armies fighting armies and conventions of war and black and white decisions when it comes to those things anymore. I mean, I think that if the president allowed either the right or the left to shove him onto one side or the other in terms of what is appropriate when you have suicide bombers, when you have people piloting planes into your buildings, then that is where the United States stands to lose. If we don't exercise the kind of restraint, and I think a sense that we are being contemplative about what this era requires and the kinds of what is right and what is wrong, what we have to uphold as a standard bearer, but also what we have to do to protect ourselves and the world, then that is what we lose here. And I think President Obama, so far, has showed that kind of restraint in protecting the people who were carrying out their jobs, in all fairness, as they were told to carry them out, but also saying that the Attorney General, the top prosecutor in the United States, will have to look carefully at these things and tease out what to do now.
Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifying this week before Congress. She was questioned by Dana Rohrabacher, Republican House member from California, and he asked about former Vice President Cheney's claims that other legal documents prove that harsh interrogation tactics yielded important intelligence.
Are you in favor of releasing the documents that Dick Cheney has been requesting be released?
Well, it won't surprise you that I don't consider him a particularly reliable source of information.
Madam Secretary, I ask you a specific question. Dick Cheney has asked for specific documents to be unclassified. We're not asking for your opinion of Dick Cheney about those documents. You want to maintain your credibility with us. What is your position on the release of those documents?
Well, Congressman, I believe that we ought to get to the bottom of this entire matter. I think it's in the best interest of our country, and that is what the president believes, and that is why he has taken the actions he did.
The time of the gentleman has expired.
I want to get some calls in here, Jack Beatty, but quickly, what do you make of that exchange?
Well, I'm all with Hillary, it is ironic, to say the least, that Dick Cheney, sort of the sultan of secrecy, is now and wants to have disclosure because it'll apparently help him. But maybe it won't. Let's have as much disclosure as possible. You know, but just for a second, for Andrea's point, she's analogizing World War I armies today, terrorism. We may have to go over on the dark side or at least close to it to defeat them. But, you know, here we have the report from the McClatchy this week, admittedly from somebody speaking anonymously, a former senior intelligence official, that the persistent torturing, the 83 times in August 2002 and the 183 times in March 2003 that two different people were waterboarded, that was because of pressure from Cheney and Rumsfeld to connect, to get information connecting Saddam and al-Qaeda, Saddam and 9/11, because they wanted to make the political case that we had to invade Iraq to defend ourselves against al-Qaeda. Now, that's the use of torture for what you could almost call reasons of spin. There's no ticking time bomb there. That's not a 9/11 analogy. That's just political convenience.
David Gerben, let me turn back to you. The Washington Post reported this morning on a debate that President Obama set up actually in the White House prior to releasing these torture memos. It was like a mock legal debate of sorts. You've advised four U.S. presidents. I mean, have you ever seen anything like this in the kind of decision-making process that we're hearing about now?
No, but I have seen, to go back to Andre's point, I have seen very deliberative processes frequently on questions in which presidents have pushed very hard to hear alternative perspectives, recognizing that these are hard calls. This is a very tough call for the president. We know that there were those who've absolutely wanted to get these memos out and wanted to take a very firm, hard line. There were others at CIA and four former CIA directors who opposed the release of the memos. I personally believe that the president has acted on there have been four big issues. I think he's handled three of them very well. First of all, changing the policies when he got in. That was the single most important thing to do, and he changed those swiftly, and good for him. Secondly, was to release these memos. I thought that was in the national interest because we did have a right to know. Thirdly, saying we're not going to prosecute the people who carried out these orders. I thought all of that was well handled. Where I think he has waffled and been less than as firm as he might have been is on where we go from here, both with regard to further investigations, a bipartisan commission of some sort. He opened the door to that early in the week, and late in the week he closed the door to that, and where he ought to go with regard to the Justice Department. I mean, is to go to Jack's point, I understand why the president says it's up to Eric Holder, his attorney general, to decide whether to prosecute the people who formulated these memos. But you know, the president didn't have any trouble reserving to himself the decision about whether to prosecute people who worked at CIA. The truth is the White House does retain power over where this prosecutorial emphasis goes. The president, it's ultimately going to be on the president's desk, not Eric Holder's desk. I think it's a fiction to say it just all belongs to Eric Holder from now on.
I've got to get some callers into the conversation at this point. Mark is up first. He's in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hello.
As an American citizen, I am appalled that this torture was carried out in my name. And it is torture, and there's no question about it. We prosecuted and imprisoned Japanese for waterboarding Americans after World War II. I think it's shameful to excuse this or to say we're going to move on. I'm less concerned about the individual CIA operatives than I am about those who instituted this policy. I'm reminded of what Ray Donovan said, the former labor secretary, after he was acquitted, he said, where do I go to get my reputation back? And as an American, I think the only place I can go to get my reputation back is in a court of law and to try these people and convict them to prove to the world that we do, in fact, adhere to the rule of law. And I think it's a shameful day. I would ask David Gergen to put aside the fact that you know most of these people, and to Andrea Seabrook to put aside the fact that you cover many of the people involved in this, and to ask yourself what the American psyche and reputation have suffered at their hands.
Mark, thank you. Andrea Seabrook, I'll let you respond.
Well, first of all, let me make clear that that I think, you know, personally, that these acts are reprehensible. But I think my point was not that it was okay, ever. My point is only that we should be contemplative about what's going on here. I think Americans would feel differently if there were, you know, there were suicide bombings going on our soil, and I don't think that that is an impossible thing to happen. I mean, I think that we just live in a very different era, and we have to think about these things carefully and not just follow our sense of outrage, which we all rightfully share, about these terrible, terrible things that were done by our government in our name.
Here, let me get another call in here. Elaine is in Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, welcome to On Point.
I'm so glad to have a chance to say this because torture under any guise and in any situation is just morally wrong, and that's the compass that we always had until this point. When we should have been contemplative was before we allowed ourselves to be drug into this war and before we allowed our nation to torture other people. What makes America great and has always made it great is that we at least allegedly live by the rule of law, both our laws that have been made by our representatives within this country and international law. And when we took it upon ourselves to say, now that we've been invaded, you know, maybe for the first time ever, I mean, other nations have been invaded by us, Iraq, so many other nations who had no choice but to be invaded by us. But now that we're invaded, now that we're threatened, we have the right to go beyond the law and do whatever we want. That's just wrong. And I think that unless we hold people accountable for making those kinds of choices, we'll continue to do it, and we will have lost our stature in the world, and we will have created more enemies than we could ever, ever restrain by finding out a little bit of information through torture.
Elaine, thank you. David Gergen, does the release of these memos, to Andrea Seabrook's point earlier, and the public airing of these interrogation techniques undermine President Obama's broader agenda? I mean, what are the implications here for bipartisanship on issues such as energy, such as health care reform to come?
Well, it's a very good question, and you know, there's already been less bipartisanship than we all hoped over these first 100 days, and I think there's blame on both sides on that. This is, if we allow this thing to get so whipped up, and there is a sense among people from who represented the last administration that there's a lynching going on here, in order to sort of cleanse our souls. Then I can guarantee that the prospects for getting constructive Republican support for health care reform and on energy, environment, which we do badly need, and I think the president wants to have that kind of constructive effort, I think those go down the drain. It's just very, very hard in this situation. But I come back to this notion, look, we do need to have a thorough airing. We do need to show the world and to show ourselves that we set higher standards. The issue, it seems to me, is whether we're going to now, when one administration comes in, it's of a different party than another, it's going to use the prosecutorial capacities and powers of that administration to go after people with whom it disagreed. We're talking now about going after lawyers who rendered their legal judgments and talking about putting them in the dock as potential criminals. And by the way, are we then also going to go after the president and the vice president who signed off on this? And very importantly, are we going to go after the congressional leaders who signed off on these procedures, now, some of whom are leading Democrats? And if we're going to be fair about this, is this path is going to take us where it leads? It leads to many, many different people. And do we really want to have now a whole set of criminal prosecutions in Washington over this issue or not? I think that's very much what's at stake here.
I want to turn to another issue in Washington this week. Andrea Seabrook, the Obama administration, said this week that an ambitious energy and climate change proposal sponsored by House Democrats could help create jobs, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but they stopped short of endorsing it. What are the chances of this particular bill passing?
Another issue in Washington this week. the chances of this passing, that's a hard one to say. I mean, there are a lot of big things on the table here, and everything right now is tied to everything else. I mean, I think just to quickly bounce back to the torture memos, I think there is a sense that President Obama released these memos thinking that he would be able to control, or at least had an expectation over what the outcomes would be politically. And it's just gone way beyond what he, or I think a lot of people in the White House, expected. And it I believe, has the chance to overtake everything else that this White House would like to do, including energy. Now, that said, there were some very inspirational words this week coming from Joe Biden, the vice president, saying that the green agenda, the green economy, is not something that happens in the future. It can happen now. We can invest in these things now, and it's very interesting. And I think possible that this could pass this year. How's that for waffling?
Well, David Gergen, EPA Chief Lisa Jackson testified before Congress this week in support of the climate energy bill that was introduced in committee. Of course, her agency has just designated carbon a pollutant, that's, of course, a major shift in U.S. policy. But she said stiff headwinds would oppose the bill, which aimed to put a cap on carbon emissions.
The no we can't crowd will spin out doomsday scenarios about runaway cost. I do not claim that we can get something for nothing. But EPA's preliminary economic modeling indicates that the investments Americans would make to implement the cap and trade program in the American Clean Energy and Security Act would be very modest compared to the benefits that science and plain common sense tell us a comprehensive energy and climate policy will deliver.
David Gergen, how do you see the interests lining up on this one?
Well, if we can keep our heads about us and conduct ourselves in a reasonably civilized way here in the next few weeks about politics, I think the prospects for getting an energy bill out of the House of Representatives this year are very high. Ed Markey, a congressman from Massachusetts, along with Henry Waxman, chairman, their chairs of two different committees, Henry Waxman of California, along with Nancy Pelosi, are showing very strong leadership in the House of Representatives to pull together a bill. Hearing started this week, as Andrea said, and I think the prospects are good that they'll get a bill done this week that many people in the environmental community will celebrate. Most of the elements of that bill are shared by the White House as being good ideas. The issue that's the cap and trade, I think they put it into a posture now where it's negotiable how you implement a cap and trade, how rapidly you put it into place, and how rapidly you impose costs and that sort of thing. That's a negotiable proposition. They're going to have more problems in the Senate. I think it's unlikely it'll pass the Senate this year, but it could well be that there by the end of the year we'll have it passed in the House. It'll be up for sort of grabs in the Senate, but that the president will go to this extremely important international conference in Copenhagen in December, where the world will try to grapple with what a post-Kyoto agreement would look like, that he would go in with a strong hand and might be able to bring China, India, and others along to an international agreement. So beneath the radar screen on economic issues, I think we're actually making a interesting and important progress on climate and energy.
Jack Beattie, I got 30 seconds before the break. Ed Markey was on this program this week. What do you see? He says compromise is likely. Do you see it?
Well, it is, but, you know, in the mix, too, 770 companies with 2,300 lobbyists who are working on this, a 300% increase in lobbyists on climate change in just 5 years. Now we have four climate change lobbyists for every member of Congress. So does the planet have a chance against them? We'll have to see.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Some unusual news this week, some of it just sad. A number of polo ponies mysteriously dropped dead on Sunday at a championship in Florida. Turns out it was caused by a pharmacy error.
It's a terrible thing, and it's not going to bring those 21 horses back. I mean, that's all gone. but at least it's down to a simple mistake.
In other news, a suspect, Philip Markoff, in the so-called Craigslist killer case, is detained. Here's a friend of the accused.
You never think that somebody that you were this close friends with would do something so horrible. And you'd think at least if it was going to happen, there would be some indication, but there is none.
And Earth Day was celebrated this week. Here's late night funny man Craig Ferguson.
Congratulations, Earth. We made it another year. Barely. This is the 39th Earth Day. So enjoy Earth, because it all goes downhill in your 40s.
We're joined today by NPR's Andrea Seabrook, by David Gergen of Harvard's Kennedy School and CNN, and by Jack Beatty. David, you moderated a discussion this week at Harvard with General David Petraeus, now CENTCOM commander. You touched on issues related to Pakistan. I know he said he's worried about what's going on there, and it's a challenge to get Pakistan to refocus its energies. And I'd like to listen to a little bit of that for a moment.
The existential threat to that country is the internal extremist threat, not the Indians. And that is a pretty big idea. It is an intellectually dislocating idea for the institutions of Pakistan, for the military, for others that have spent, just as we spent, you know, decades faced off against the Warsaw Pact and almost comfortable with that.
David Gergen, what's your sense of Petraeus' mood on this issue?
He's very sober about the prospects for Afghanistan and Pakistan. He does see it as one theater, AFPAC now, as it's often called. But just as he went into Iraq trying to undersell prospects and then overachieve in terms of results, I think what he hopes here is that they're after a period in which things will look to be getting worse, that they will start to get better, just as they did in Iraq. There is a big, big difference. Of course, there are lots of differences. Jack could point a lot of those out. One of the big differences here is that we have U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and we are working alongside others, Afghan forces, to try to bring a better outcome there. But in Pakistan, you know, our hands are pretty tied as a U.S. military, and we have to rely on the Pakistanis. And it's after pouring all this money into Pakistan, as we did under the Bush administration, we have so little to show for it, and we have such an unresponsive Pakistani army that as these Islamic militants begin to spread out of the northwest now, and they're, 70 miles from Islamabad, the Pakistani army is still not responding in a forceful way. They have, as General Petraeus said when he came to for our salute to military veterans at Harvard, which we were so pleased about, and we were honored to have him, there is such a strong view in Pakistan that India is the problem, not internal Pakistan, that they train for that and they refuse to fight these militants. And that, unless we get a hold of Pakistan, Pakistan is becoming probably the most dangerous place in the world for United States security interests at the moment.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testified in Congress on Wednesday about, among other things, the chaos in Pakistan. This comes courtesy of CNN, this clip.
I do want to talk about Pakistan, which I think poses a mortal threat to the security and safety of our country and the world. And I want to take this occasion in this public forum to state unequivocally that not only do the Pakistani government officials, but the Pakistani people and the Pakistani diaspora, many of whom are extremely successful Americans here in academia, business, the professions, and so much else, need to speak out forcefully against a policy that is ceding more and more territory to the insurgents, to the Taliban, to Al-Qaeda, to the allies that are in this terrorist syndicate.
Jack Beatty, I'll get to you on this, but Andrea Seabrook, what's your sense of how closely Congress is paying attention to this?
Well, it all depends on how this further conflict goes. I mean, everybody is kind of waiting to see what happens now, because this is a pretty big shift. You know, the last administration was still talking about how Pakistan is one of our biggest allies in the war on terror. And I think that you're seeing the great ship of government turn towards being against a lot of the policies that government is supporting. And so I think members of Congress are kind of trying to wait and see how they should respond. And I think Secretary Clinton was speaking directly to that when she was was asking for Pakistanis and the Pakistani diaspora, including Americans, to speak up, to let their congresspeople know, their government know, that it's okay to oppose this government, which is one of our, again, biggest allies in the war on terror.
Jack Beatty, Pakistani authorities deployed special forces to a strategically important district about 70 miles from the capital, Islamabad, an area that's come under effective control of the Taliban in the last several days. Another indication of really the gathering strength of this insurgency.
Yes, it's happening so fast. You know, there was a piece in the Times, I think, on Monday that really got my attention that pointed out the, you know, we're talking about the religious radicalism of this group, but that really Pakistan has the material for what one expert called a social revolution. That is to say, yes, it's a democracy, but it's landlord rule pretty much in many of these places. And the Taliban are going to the landless and to the agricultural laborers and saying, look, let's throw over this oligarchy and give you people a better, have your own land. You can do what you want. And one commentator said that could be in the most inflammatory of all possible positions in the great Punjab region of Pakistan. In other words, this isn't just a matter of, you know, Islamic fundamentalism and so on. There's a social element here, and that could be just explosive in Pakistan.
David Gergen, staying overseas for a moment. Twin suicide bombers struck outside the gates of the holiest Shiite site in Baghdad on Friday, killing at least 60 people, wounding scores more. It's a single deadliest day. Actually, that came after the single deadliest day in Iraq in more than a year. What do you make of this fresh outburst of violence, and is it concerning?
It is concerning because we're on the verge of wanting to leave here. You know, we have pretty firm plans to go, but the fear had always been when you start to pull the plug, will things start to pull apart there? Have we been the glue that's held this together? And if when we leave, will it pull apart? And we don't. What we've had in the last 3 or 4 weeks is a series of incidents, mostly car bombs, mostly sort of these violent explosions, we should keep in perspective. On no single day have we seen the kind of deaths, I believe, that are as high as what we saw every day on average back in late 2004 and 2005, 2006, into early 2007. In other words, averages were much – even the spikes we're getting now are not taking us back to where we were. But they do start to raise serious questions. Is this a society that really can hold together once we get out? And how much is that going to complicate the process of getting out? So, yes, they're very concerning.
Back home now again, here is Congresswoman Jane Harman on CNN this week with host Wolf Blitzer. News reports have asserted that she was wiretapped, making a quid pro quo deal with an Israeli agent. Harman said that she's been smeared by anonymous sources and asked Attorney General Holder to put it all out in the open.
They're quoting snippets of allegedly taped conversation. So I don't know what these snippets mean. I don't know whether these intercepts were legal. And that's why I asked Eric Holder to put it all out there
because
in public.
Because the New York Times and Congressional Quarterly, they say there are actually transcripts of this recorded wiretap.
Well, let's see if there are, or wiretaps. And let's see who else was wiretapped. I mean, lots of members of Congress talk to advocacy organizations.
Andrea Seabrook, what do you make of this evolving controversy?
Well, I think, you know, Harman was on many news outlets this week responding to this, including on NPR. And her argument that the entire transcripts, unredacted, of these conversations should be released is kind of an odd request. I mean, you can understand from her point of view that she would like that. But according to the stories so far that have been out there, the transcripts are of partial transcripts of wiretaps of other people, not of Congresswoman Harman, that she happened to be talking to on the phone, and that she was picked up in these other wiretaps. Now, the story goes well beyond this. I mean, there's the whole part about what it was she actually picked up and whether she agreed to a quid pro quo, but then didn't actually carry it out. She says she never actually contacted anyone in the Justice Department or in the White House to try and have the felonies lowered for the Israeli agents that had been convicted of spying and so on. But then, apparently, according to these stories, the Attorney General at the time, you know who
Roberto
I'm talking
Gonzalez.
About. Yes, thank you. All I could think
soon
of
they
was,
forget.
All I could think of was John Ashcroft. I was thinking, not John Ashcroft. Alberto Gonzalez agreed to keep this all under wraps and quash a possible investigation of Harman herself in order for her help in the whole blowback of the torture situation being released. It's just mind-boggling how deep this goes. And I think overall, my personal belief about all this is, looking at it, it looks like large parts of our government were ill at the time. I mean, there's just like almost a sickness going through the government that these things, which appear to be perfectly legal or maybe, but are incredibly ethically questionable.
Listen, I'm wholly biased on this issue because I've known Jane Harman and her husband, Sid Harman, for a long time, and I've known them well. And I found them to be outstanding citizens of this country who've been enormously generous and caring about the country in all sorts of ways. And if, in my judgment, it's extraordinarily unfair to this woman who has served in Congress to put out excerpts and not put out the whole conversations. If they've got the conversations, put them out there, let things come to light, and then she, I am sure, will be very able to defend herself about whatever it is. But we should know, as we go down these tracks, that there are people who have long and distinguished records. When things like this come up, those people deserve a fairness. And the way they are treated in the press and the way they are treated by anonymous people who sort of leak a little bit of this and a little bit of that out in ways that do smear them.
Let's get to Detroit for a moment. Ford Motor Company posted a smaller-than-expected first-quarter loss and said that it's on track to at least break even in 2011. However, the Treasury Department is directing Chrysler to prepare a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing as soon as next week. News from Detroit. News about U.S. banks. Federal bank regulators are expected to start sharing preliminary results of stress tests with the banks that have been scrutinized since February. Jack Beatty, what do you expect to see in those findings? Will they be significant?
Oh, well, I don't know. And candor there could be actually against their own interest. And I'm not clear, maybe David could help me, on how much autonomy have the banks done these tests themselves. That's what Paul Krugman seems to imply. He says these are like self-esteem tests that the banks have given themselves. Or has the government done it? And if the government has done it, will the government dare release information that could actually hurt the bank's lending capacity?
David?
It's a good question. Jack raises exactly how it's done. My understanding, Jack, was that the banks did supply the information, but that there were effects of federal auditors who came in to do these stress tests. And certainly the Fed set the terms for what the stress test would be and then asked the banks to provide the information, whether they did. I doubt they had the time or a capacity to go in each bank and go through all the records themselves. But I think the stress tests were a good idea in and of themselves, but it may be that the administration has boxed itself in a little bit here because now there's this really delicate question of what do you do with the information, and there's no question that the strong banks are going to want to get that information out to protect themselves. But every time a strong bank can go out and protect itself, then a weak bank is put in an even weaker position because people who do business with that bank are going to flee. They're going to go to the strong banks. And so that's why I think you can see the storm clouds gathering now over Bank of America and in particular over the CEO of Bank of America. There are a lot of indications from these various news stories that came out, Financial Times front page Friday morning this week, saying that the Andrew Cuomo's investigation in New York is really seems to be putting pressure on Ken Lewis at Bank of America to step down. It looks like there's a lot of pressure coming on Bank of America and probably on Citi as well.
I want to end on this point. President Obama is coming up on the 100-day mark of his administration. I'd like you all to give us a report card quickly. Andrea Seabrook, you first.
Bipartisanship, he gets a C or a C minus. He tried. Agenda through Congress, he gets a B plus. And everything else I'm going to leave to the other guys.
All right, Jack Beatty, you want to go next?
Well, I think he's done very well indeed. And, you know, I mean, he major legislation, the stimulus bill. But take a look at the country. You know, I was shocked to see for the first time, I think, in a long time, more Americans now think the country is on the right track than the wrong track. 31-point shift just since October in that metric. Much of that is owing to President Obama and to the leadership he's displayed. Not always short-footedly, but I think, you know, people sense about him, as they may have sensed about FDR, that he's willing to try anything, that he's there working all the time to try things, to try to get this economy going. Mm-hmm. And I think that the public is appreciating that. Mm-hmm.
David Gergen, final word.
President Obama, the man, one of the singularly most impressive people we've seen in this office in a long, long time. President Obama, the leader, off to a very promising start. President Obama on national security. I think he's put together an outstanding team. They've had a few bobbles here and there, but it's an excellent team. President Obama on domestic policy, starting with the economy. Incomplete. We don't know where this is going yet. I'm among those who are concerned about whether this economic policy is going to work and pull us out. But overall, I think that the country very much wants this man to succeed. I think a large majority of Americans are investing their faith in him.
Wonderful panel discussion. Thank you very much, all. David Gergen served as presidential advisor to Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton, now a director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. David, always great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Andrea Seabrook, congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. Appreciate your time, Andrea. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Do have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.